the answer he had. Loretta sat on the floor of the quaking schoolhouse, her brother tucked in close beside her, both wearing bandanas drawn over their mouths and noses, bandit style. Aunt was trying to be brave, but he flinched every time a particularly fierce gust of wind hit the building and rattled the glass. Dust rained down from the ceiling. Loretta felt it collecting in her hair, on her shoulders. Wind battered the wooden walls, wailed in a high, almost human scream. Panicked birds kept hitting the glass. When the storm first struck, Mrs. Buslick had called them all in and made them sit together in the corner farthest from the windows. She'd tried reading a story, but no one could concentrate, and in time, no one could hear her voice, so she gave up and closed the book. There had been at least 10 of these dust storms in the past year. One day this spring, the wind and dirt had blown for 12 straight hours, so long that they'd had to cook and eat and do chores in the raging dust. Grandma and Mom said they should pray. Pray. As if lighting candles and kneeling could stop all of this. Clearly, if God was watching the people of the Great Plains, he wanted them to either leave or die. When the storm finally ended and silence swept into the schoolhouse, the children sat there, traumatized and big-eyed and covered in dirt. Mrs. Buslick slowly unfolded from her seat on the floor. As she stood, dirt rained down from her lap. The sand outline of her body on the floor remained behind, a dirt design. She went to the door, opened it, to reveal a beautiful blue sky. Loretta saw Mrs. Buslick sigh with relief. The exhalation made her cough. "Okay, kids," she said in a scratchy voice. "It's over." Aunt looked at Loretta. His freckled face was brown with dirt above the bandana that covered his mouth and nose. By rubbing his eyes, he'd given himself a raccoon look. Tears hung stubbornly onto his lashes, looking like beads of mud. She pulled down her bandana.
"Come on, Aunt," she said.
Her voice was thin and scratchy. Loretta and Stella and Aunt retrieved their book bags and empty lunch pails and left the schoolhouse. Sophia shuffled along behind them, her head hung. Loretta held Aunt's hand firmly in hers as she stepped from the building. Town was catastrophe quiet. The carbide arc street lamps, such a source of community pride 4 years ago when they had been installed, were lit because people and cars and animals needed light to find safety in the storm. They walked up Main Street. Tumbleweeds were caught in the boardwalk. Windows were boarded up from both the depression and the dust storms. When they neared the train depot, Stella said,
"It's getting bad, Lolo,"
quietly, as if she were afraid her voice would carry all the way to her parents' house. Loretta had no answer to that. In the Martinelli house, it had been bad for years. She watched Stella walk away, shoulders hunched as if to protect her from whatever hardship was waiting. She climbed over a new dune of sand that had been swept into the street and turned the corner on her way home. Sophia followed her sister. Loretta and Aunt kept walking. It felt as if they were the only two people left in the world. They passed several for sale signs on fence posts, and then there was nothing. No houses, no fences, no animals, no windmills. Just endless brown-gold dirt molded into hills and dunes. Sand piled up at the base of the telephone poles. One pole was down. Loretta was the first to hear the slow, dull clip-clop of hooves.
"Mommy!"
Aunt yelled. Loretta looked up. Mom drove the wagon toward them. She sat strained forward, as if she wanted Milo to move faster, faster, but the poor old gelding was as exhausted and thirsty as the rest of them. Aunt pulled free and started to run. Mom brought the horse to a halt and jumped down from the wagon. She ran toward them, her face brown with dirt, her dress shredded into fraying strips from the waist down, apron flapping, her pale blonde hair brown with dust.
Mom swept Aunt into a hug, pulled him off his feet, twirled him around as if she'd thought she'd never see him again, and covered his dirty face with kisses. Loretta remembered those kisses. Mom had smelled of lavender soap and talcum powder in the good years. Not anymore. Loretta couldn't remember the last time she'd let Mom kiss her. Loretta didn't want the kind of love that trapped. She wanted to be told she could fly high, be anything, and go anywhere. She wanted the things her father wanted. Someday, she would smoke cigarettes and go to jazz clubs and get a job. Be modern. Her mother's idea of a woman's place was too sad for Loretta to bear. Mom helped Aunt up into the wagon's front seat, then came to stand in front of Loretta.
"You okay?"
Mom asked, tucking the hair behind Loretta's ear, her touch lingering there.
"Yeah, great,"
Loretta said, hearing the sharpness in her voice. She knew it was wrong to be angry with her mother now. The weather wasn't her fault, but Loretta couldn't help herself. She was mad at the world, and somehow that meant she was mad at her mom most of all.
"Aunt looks like he's been crying."
"He was scared."
"I'm glad his big sister was with him."
How could Mom smile at a time like this? It was irritating.
"You know your teeth are brown with dirt,"
Loretta said. Her mother flinched and instantly stopped smiling. Loretta had hurt Mom's feelings. Again. Loretta suddenly felt like crying. Before her mom could see the emotion, Loretta headed for the back of the wagon.
"You can sit up here with us," Mom said.
"Seeing where we're going ain't any better than seeing where we've been. The view never changes."
"Isn't,"
Mom corrected automatically.
"Oh, right,"
Loretta said.
"Education is everything."
As they headed home, Loretta stared out at the flat, flat land. All the trees that lined their driveway were dying. The hot, dry years had turned them a sick gray-brown. Their leaves had turned into crunchy, blackened confetti and been swept away by the wind. Only three of them were even still standing. The dusty soil lay in heaps and dunes at the base of every fence post. Nothing grew or thrived in the fields. There was not a blade of green grass anywhere. Russian thistles, tumbleweed, and yucca were the only living plants to be seen. The rotting body of something, a jackrabbit maybe, lay in a heap of sand. Crows picked at it. Mom pulled the wagon to a stop in the yard. Milo pawed at the hard earth beneath his hooves.
"Loretta, you put Milo away. I'll get the preserved lemons and make lemonade," Mom said.
"Fine,"
Loretta said glumly. She climbed out of the wagon and took hold of the reins and led the horse and wagon toward the barn. Poor Milo moved so slowly, Loretta couldn't help feeling sorry for this bay gelding that had once been her best friend in the whole world.
"It's okay, boy. We all feel like that."
She petted his velvet-soft muzzle, remembering the day her daddy had taught her to ride. It had been a bluebird day, with wheat a sea of gold all around. She'd been scared, so scared, to climb all the way up onto that grown-up-sized saddle. Daddy helped her up, whispered, "Don't worry," and moved back beside Mom, who looked as nervous as Loretta felt. Loretta hadn't fallen off once. Daddy told her she was a natural and told the family at supper that Loretta was the best little horsewoman he'd ever seen. Loretta had soaked up his praise, grown to fit it. And after that, for years, she and Milo had been inseparable. She did her homework in his stall whenever she could, both of them munching on carrots she pulled from the garden.
"I miss you, boy,"
Loretta said, stroking the side of his head. The gelding snorted, blew wet, sandy mucus on Loretta's bare arm.
"Ick."
Loretta opened the double doors of the barn that was her grandfather's pride and joy. The large barn had a wide center aisle where the tractor and truck were parked, and two stalls on either side, both of which opened onto corrals. Two for the horses and two for the cows. A loft that had once been stacked with fragrant green bales of hay was emptying fast. Everyone knew it was her daddy's favorite hiding spot, that loft. He loved to sit up there and smoke cigarettes and drink hooch and dream big dreams. He stayed up there more and more these days. As Loretta unharnessed the gelding, she smelled the rubber on the tires and the metallic taint of the engine, along with the comforting aromas of sweet hay and manure. In the side-by-side stalls at the end, their other gelding, Bruno, snorted softly in greeting, banged his nose into the stall door.
"I'll get you boys some water," Loretta said,
easing the slimy bit out of Milo's mouth. She turned him into his stall, the back of which opened out to the corral. As she closed the stall door, clicked it shut, she heard something. What? She left the barn, stepped outside, and looked around. There it was again, a deep rumbling. Not thunder, there wasn't a cloud in the sky. The ground trembled beneath her feet, made a loud, crunching, splintering sound. A crack opened up in the earth, a giant snaking zigzag. Boom! Dust geysered into the air, dirt crashed into the new crevasse, the sides crumbled away. A part of the barbed wire fence fell into the opening. New cracks crawled off from the main one, like branches on a tree limb. A 50-foot zigzagging crevasse opened in the yard. Dead roots stuck out from the crumbling dirt sides like skeletal hands. Loretta stared at it in horror. She had heard stories of this, the land breaking open from dryness, but she'd thought it was a myth. Now it wasn't just the animals and the people who were drying up. The land itself was dying. Loretta and her daddy were in their favorite place, sitting side by side on the platform beneath the giant blades of the windmill. As the sky turned red in the last few moments before darkfall, she could see to the very end of the world she knew and imagine what lay beyond.
"I want to see the ocean," Loretta said.
It was a game they played, imagining other lives they would someday live. She couldn't remember now when they'd begun. She just knew that it felt more important these days because of the new sadness in her father. At least it felt new. She sometimes wondered if his sadness had always been there, and she'd just finally grown up enough to see it. "You will, Lolo." Usually, he said, "We will." He slumped forward, rested his forearms on his thighs. Thick black hair fell in unruly waves over his broad forehead. It was cut close to the sides of his head, but Mom didn't have time to tend it closely, and the edges were ragged.
"You want to see the Brooklyn Bridge, remember?"
Loretta said. It scared her to think of her father's unhappiness. She hardly got to spend any time with him lately, and she loved him more than anything in the world, he who made her feel like a special girl with a big future. He'd taught her to dream. He was the opposite of her dour workhorse mom who just plodded forward, doing chores, never having any fun. They even looked alike, she and her daddy. Everyone said so. The same thick black hair and fine-boned faces, the same full lips. The only thing Loretta had inherited from her mother was her blue eyes. But even with her mother's eyes, Loretta saw things the way her daddy did.
"Sure, Lolo. How could I forget? You and I will see the world someday. We will stand at the top of the Empire State Building or attend a movie premiere on Hollywood Boulevard. Hell, we might even..."
"Rafe!"
Mom stood at the base of the windmill, looking up. In her brown kerchief and flour sack dress and sagging stockings, she looked practically as old as Grandma. As always, she stood ramrod stiff. She had perfected an unyielding, unforgiving stance, shoulders back, spine straight, chin up. Wisps of corn silk fine pale blonde hair crept out from beneath her kerchief.
"Hey, Elsa, you found us."
Daddy flashed Loretta a conspiratorial smile.
"Your father wants help watering while it's cool," Mom said. "And I know a girl who has chores to finish."
Daddy bumped his shoulder against Loretta's and then climbed down the windmill. The boards creaked and swayed at his steps. He jumped down the last few feet, faced Mom. Loretta crawled down behind him, but she wasn't fast enough. When she got down, her father was already headed toward the barn.
"How come you can't let anyone have any fun?" she said to her mother.
"I want you and your father to have fun, Loretta, but I've had a long day, and I need your help putting the laundry away."
"You're so mean," Loretta said.
"I'm not mean, Loretta," Mom said.
Loretta heard the hurt in her mother's voice, but didn't care. That anger of hers, always so close to the surface, surged up, uncontrollable.
"Don't you care that Daddy is unhappy?"
"Life is tough, Loretta. You need to be tougher or it will turn you inside out, as it has your father."
"Life isn't what makes my daddy sad."
"Oh, really? Tell me then, with all your worldly experience, what is it that makes your father unhappy?"
"You,"
Loretta said. 8. 104 degrees in the shade, and the well was drying up. The water in the tank had to be carefully conserved, carried by the bucketful to the house. At night, they gave the animals what water they could. The vegetables that Elsa and Rose had tended with such loving care were dead. Between yesterday's wind and dust and the relentless sun, every plant had either been torn out by the roots or lay wilted and dead. She heard Rose come up beside her.
"There's no point watering," Elsa said.
"No."
She heard the heartbreak in her mother-in-law's voice and wished she could say something to help.
"You've been awfully quiet today," Rose said.
"Unlike my usual chatty self," Elsa said, to deflect a conversation she didn't want to have.
Rose bumped her shoulder against Elsa's arm.
"Tell me what is wrong. Besides the obvious, of course."
"Loretta is angry at me. All of the time. I swear, before I even speak, she gets mad at whatever it is I'm about to say."
"She is at that age. It's more than that, I think."
Rose stared out at the devastated fields.
"My son," she said. "Stupido. He is filling her head with dreams."
"He's unhappy."
"Psh," Rose said impatiently. "Who isn't? Look at what is happening."
"My parents, my family," Elsa said quietly.
This was something she rarely talked about, a pain too deep for words, especially when words wouldn't change anything. Loretta's opinion of Elsa lately had brought all that heartache of youth back. Elsa remembered the day she'd taken Loretta, swaddled in pink, to her parents' house, hoping her marriage would allow them to accept her again. Elsa had worked for weeks on a lovely pink dress for the baby, trimmed it in lace. She knit a matching cap. Finally, she borrowed the truck and drove to Dalhart alone, pulling up at the back gate. She remembered every moment in detail. Walking up the path, the smell of roses, everything in bloom, a clear blue sky, bees buzzing around the roses. She had felt both nervous and proud. She was a wife now, with a baby girl so beautiful even strangers remarked upon it. Knocking on the door. The sound of footsteps, heels on hardwood. Mama answering the door, dressed for church, wearing pearls. Papa in a brown suit.
"Look,"
Elsa had said, her smile unsteady, her eyes filling with unwanted tears.
"My daughter, Loretta."
Mama, craning her neck, peering down at Loretta's small, perfect face.
"Look, Eugene, how dark her skin is. Take your disgrace away, Elsinore."
The door slamming shut. Elsa had made a point of never seeing them or speaking to them again, but even so, their absence caused an ache that wouldn't go away. Apparently, you couldn't stop loving some people, or needing their love, even when you knew better.
"Yes,"
Rose said, looking up at her.
They didn't love me. I never knew why. But now Loretta has turned so angry, I wonder if she sees me the same way they did. I could never do anything right in their eyes either.
Do you remember what I told you on the day Loretta was born?
Elsa almost smiled.
That she would love me as no one else ever would, and make me crazy, and try my soul?
See. And you see how right I was.
About part of it, I guess. She certainly breaks my heart.
Yes. I was a trial to my poor mama, too. The love, it comes in the beginning of her life, and at the end of yours. God is cruel that way. Your heart, is it too broken to love?
Of course not.
So, you go on.
She shrugged, as if to say, motherhood.
What choice is there for us?
It just hurts.
Rose was silent for a while. Finally, she said,
yes.
In the distant field, Tony and Rafe were hard at work, planting winter wheat in ground that was as powdery as flour at the surface and hard beneath. For 3 years they'd planted wheat and prayed for rain and gotten too little and grown no crop at all.
This season it will be better, Rose said.
We still have milk and eggs to sell, and soap.
Small blessings mattered. Elsa and Rose combined their individual optimism into a communal hope, stronger and more durable in the combination. Rose put an arm around Elsa's waist, and Elsa leaned in to the smaller woman. From the moment of Loretta's birth, and in all the years since, Rose had become Elsa's mother in every way that mattered. Even if they didn't speak of their love or share their feelings in long, heartfelt conversations, the bond was there, sturdy. They'd sewn their lives together in the silent way of women unused to conversation. Day after day, they worked together, prayed together, held their growing family together through the hardships of farm life. When Elsa had lost her third child, a son who never drew breath, it was Rose who held Elsa and let her cry and said,
"Some lives are not ours to hold on to. God makes his choices without us."
Rose, who spoke for the first time about her own lost children, had showed Elsa that grief could be born one day, one chore at a time.
"I'll go water the animals," Elsa said.
Rose nodded.
"I'll dig up what I can."
Elsa grabbed a metal bucket from the porch and wiped the grit from its inside. At the pump, she put on gloves to protect her hands from the blazing hot metal and pumped a bucket full of water. Carrying the sloshing pail carefully back to the house, not wanting to spill a precious drop, she was nearing the barn when she heard a sound like a saw blade grinding over metal. She slowed, listened, heard it again. She set down the bucket and moved around the corner of the barn and saw Rafe standing by the new crack in the ground, his arms propped on the head of a rake, his hat pulled low on his downcast face, crying. Elsa walked over to him, stood silently by. Words were something she could never pull up easily, not for him. She was always afraid of saying the wrong thing, of pushing him away when she wanted to draw him near. He was like Loretta, full of mercurial moods and given to bouts of passion. It frightened her, those moods she could neither tame nor understand. So she held her tongue.
"I don't know how long I can stand all of this," he said.
"It will rain soon. You'll see."
"How can you not break?" he said,
wiping his eyes with the back of his hand. Elsa didn't know how to answer that. They were parents. They had to stay strong for the children. Or did he mean something else?
"Because the kids need us not to."
He sighed, and she knew she'd said the wrong thing.
That September, heat roared across the Great Plains, day after day, week after week, burning away whatever had survived the summer. Elsa stopped sleeping well, or at all, really. She was plagued by nightmares of emaciated children and dying crops. The livestock, 2 horses and 2 cows, all bones and hollows, were being kept alive by eating the prickly Russian thistles that grew wild. The small amount of hay they'd harvested was nearly gone. The animals stood still for hours at a time, as if afraid that every step could kill them. In the hottest part of the day, when the temperature rose above 115 degrees, their eyes became glassy and unfocused. When they could, the family carried pails of water to the corral, but it was always too little. Every drop of water that came up from the well had to be carefully conserved. The chickens rarely moved, they were so lethargic. They lay like feathered heaps in the dirt, not even bothering to squawk when they were disturbed. Eggs were still being laid, and each one was like a nugget of gold, although Elsa feared that each one would be their last. Today, like most mornings, she was awake before the rooster crowed. She lay in bed, trying not to think about the dead garden or the dried-up ground or the coming winter. When sunlight began to stream through the windows, she sat up and read a chapter of Jane Eyre, letting the familiar words soothe and comfort her. Then she put the novel aside and got out of bed, careful not to waken Rafe. After dressing, she took a moment to stare down at her sleeping husband. He'd been out in the barn until late last night and finally stumbled to bed smelling of whiskey. She had been restless too, but neither had turned to the other for solace. They didn't know how, she supposed. They'd never learned to comfort each other. Or maybe there was no comfort to be found when life was so bad. What she knew was that the slim hold she'd had on him was loosening. In the past few weeks, she'd noticed how frequently he turned away from her. Was it since the dust storms had ruined their fields and tripled the work, or since he'd planted the winter wheat with his father? He stayed up late, reading newspapers as if they were adventure novels, staring out windows, studying maps. When he finally stumbled to bed, he rolled away from her and thumped into a sleep so deep that sometimes she feared he had died during the night. Last night, as so often, when he finally came to their bed, she lay in the dark, aching for him to turn to her, touch her. But even if he had, they both would have remained unsatisfied. He never spoke while they were intimate, not even whispers about his need, and he rushed through the act as if he regretted it before he began. Sometimes Elsa felt lonelier when their lovemaking ended than she had before it began. He said he stayed away from her because she conceived so easily, but she knew the truth was darker than that. As always, it came down to her unattractiveness. Of course he had difficulty wanting her. And clearly she was not good in bed. He rushed through it so. In earlier years, she had dreamed of boldly reaching for him, changing how they touched each other, exploring his body with her hands and her mouth. Then, upon waking, she'd felt frustrated and swollen with a desire she could neither express nor share. She'd waited years for him to see it, see her, and reach out. Lately, though, that dream felt far away. Or maybe she was just too tired and worn out these days to believe in it. She left their bedroom and walked down the hallway. She paused at each of the kids' bedroom doors and peered in. The peacefulness in their sleeping faces squeezed her heart. At times like this, she remembered Laredo when she'd been young and happy, always laughing, her arms thrown open for a hug. When Elsa had been Loretta's favorite person in the world. She went into the kitchen, which smelled of coffee and baking bread. Her in-laws didn't sleep anymore either. Like her, they held on to the unproven hope/belief that more work might save them. Pouring herself a cup of black coffee, she drank it quickly and washed out the cup, then stepped into her brown shoes, the heels almost worn away, and grabbed her sun hat.
Outside, she squinted into the bright sun, tented a gloved hand over her eyes. Tony was already at work, taking advantage of the relative cool of the morning. He was putting up hay, what little there was, and doing it early because he was afraid the afternoon heat would kill their horses. Both geldings moved more slowly every day. Sometimes the lowing moans of their hunger was enough to make Elsa weep. Elsa waved at her father-in-law, and he waved back. Tying on her hat, she made a quick stop at the outhouse and then hauled water by the pailful to the kitchen for laundry. There was no reason to water the orchard or the garden anymore. By the time she finished carrying water, her arms ached and she was sweating. At last, she went to her own little garden. She'd hollowed out a square of ground directly below the kitchen window in a narrow patch of morning shade. It was too small to grow anything of value, so she'd planted some flower seeds. All she wanted was a little green, maybe even a splash of color. She knelt in the powdery dirt, rearranging the stones she'd set in a semicircle to delineate the garden. The latest wind had pushed a few out of place. In the center, still standing, was her precious calico aster, with its leggy brown stems and defiant green leaves. "If you can just make it through this heat wave, it will cool down soon," Elsa said, pouring a few precious drops of water onto the soil, watching it darken instantly. "I know you want to bloom."
"Talking to your little friend again."
Elsa sat back on her heels and looked up, blinded for a moment by the bright sun. Rafe stood in a halo of yellow light. He rarely bothered to shave these days, so the lower half of his face was covered in thick, dark stubble. He knelt on one knee beside her and laid a hand on her shoulder. She could feel the slight dampness in his palm, the way his hand trembled from last night's drinking. Elsa couldn't help leaning into his touch just enough to make his hold feel possessive.
"I'm sorry if I woke you up when I got in," he said.
She turned. The brim of her straw hat touched the brim of his, made a scratching sound.
"It was nothing."
"I don't know how you can stand all this."
"All this?
Our life. Digging for scraps. Being hungry. How skinny our kids are."
"We have more than lots of folks have these days."
"You want too little, Elsa."
"You make that sound like a bad thing."
"You're a good woman."
He made that sound like a bad thing, too. Elsa didn't know how to respond, and in the silence of her confusion, he rose slowly, tiredly, to his feet. She stood in front of him, tilted her face up. She knew what he saw. A tall, unattractive woman with sunburned, peeling skin and a mouth that was too big and eyes that seemed to have drunk all the color God allotted her.
"I need to get to work," he said. "It's already so goddamn hot I can't breathe."
Elsa stared after him, thinking, "Look back, smile." But he didn't. And finally, she stopped waiting and headed in to start the laundry. The first Pioneer Days celebration had taken place in 1905, back in the days when Lonesome Tree was a vast plain of blue-green buffalo grass and the Exitee Ranch employed 1,000 cowboys. Homesteaders had been drawn to this land by brochures that promised they could grow cabbages the size of baby carriages and wheat, all without irrigation. Dry farming, it was called, and it was promised to them here. Indeed. Loretta was pretty sure the party was really about men celebrating themselves.
"You look beautiful," Mom said,
coming into Loretta's bedroom without even knocking. Loretta felt a rush of irritation at the intrusion. She bit back an angry remark about privacy. Mom came up behind her. For a moment, their faces were reflected together in the mirror above Loretta's washstand. Beside Loretta's tanned skin and blunt-cut black hair, Mom's pallor was remarkable. How was it that Mom's skin never tanned, just burned and peeled?
She hadn't even bothered to do anything with her hair beyond braiding it in a coronet. Stella's mom always wore cosmetics and had her hair pinned and curled, even in these hard times. Mom didn't even try to look good. The dress she wore, a floral flower sack house dress with a button-up bodice, was at least a size too big and just exaggerated how tall and thin she was.
I'm sorry I couldn't make you a new dress, or at least buy you some socks. Next year, when it rains.
Loretta couldn't imagine how her mother could even say those words anymore. Loretta pulled away, smoothing the waves she'd coaxed into her chin-length hair and ruffling her bangs.
Where's Daddy?
He's hitching up the wagon.
Loretta turned.
Can Stella spend the night after?
Sure, Mom said. But you'll have to do your chores in the morning.
Loretta was so happy, she actually hugged her mother, but Mom ruined it by hanging on too long and squeezing too hard. Loretta yanked free. Mom looked sad.
Go downstairs, she said. Help Grandma pack up the food.
Loretta bolted out of the bedroom and hurried down to the kitchen, where Grandma was already busy packing up the pot of minestrone soup. A plateful of her cannoli with sweetened ricotta filling waited on the table, both of which only the other Italian families would eat. Loretta covered the tray of desserts with a dish towel and carried it out to the wagon. She climbed up into the back and sat close to her father, who put his arm around her and held her close. Grandma and Grandpa took their places up front. Mom was the last one to climb up into the back of the wagon. Aunt tucked in close to Mom and talked constantly, his high-pitched voice rising in excitement as they neared the town. Daddy, she noticed, was uncharacteristically quiet. Lonesome Tree appeared on the horizon, a meager town squatted on a table-flat plain, surrounded by nothing. Only the water tower stood tall against the cloudless blue sky. Once, patriotism had run high in town. Loretta remembered how the old man used to talk about the Great War at every community gathering. Who fought, who died, and who grew the wheat to feed the troops. Back then, pioneer days had been an expression of the farmers' pride in themselves and a celebration of their hard work. Americans, prosperous. They draped the stores of Main Street in red, white, and blue bunting and planted American flags in the flower pots and painted patriotic slogans on the windows. The men had gathered to drink and smoke and congratulate each other on winning the war and turning grazing land into farmland. They drank homemade hooch and played music on their fiddles and guitars, while the women did all the work. Or that was how Loretta saw it. In the week leading up to the celebration, Mom and Grandma Rose cooked more, made more homemade macaroni, did more laundry, and had to darn or repair every scrap of clothing that was to be worn. No matter how dire times were, how tight money was, Mom wanted her children to look presentable. Today, there was no bunting. Too hot to put up, she figured, or else some woman finally said, "Why bother?" No flowers or flags in the flower pots, no patriotic slogans. Instead, Loretta saw hobos gathered around the train depot, wearing rags, their back pockets turned inside out in what were being called Hoover flags. A shoe with holes was a Hoover shoe. Everyone knew who to blame for the Depression, but not how to fix it. Clop, clop, clop down Main Street. Only two automobiles were parked out here. Both belonged to bankers. Banksters, they were called these days, for the way they cheated hard-working folk out of their land and then went bust and closed their doors, keeping the money people had thought was safe. Grandpa maneuvered the horse and wagon up to the schoolhouse and parked. Loretta heard music wafting through the open doors and the sound of stomping feet. She launched herself out of the wagon and hurried to the schoolhouse. Inside, the party was on. A makeshift band played in the corner, and a few couples were dancing. Off to the right were the food tables. There wasn't a lot of food out, but after the years of drought, Loretta knew it was a feast the women had worried and slaved over.
Loretta!
Loretta saw Stella moving toward her. As usual, Stella and her younger sister Sophia were the only girls in the room in pretty new party dresses. Loretta felt a pinch of jealousy and put it aside. Stella was her best friend, who cared about dresses. Loretta and Stella came together as they always did, grasping hands, heads tilted together.
"Say, what's the story, Morning Glory?"
Loretta said, trying to sound in the know.
"I'm behind the grind, don't you know?"
Stella answered. Stella's parents came up behind the girls, stopped to talk to the Martinellis. Loretta heard Mr. Devereaux say,
"I got another postcard from my brother-in-law. There's railroad work in Oregon. You should think about it, Tony. Rafe?"
Like women had no opinions. And her grandfather's reply,
"I don't blame nobody for leaving, Ralph, but it ain't for us. This land."
Not that again. The land. Loretta pulled Stella away from the grown-ups and ran past them, wearing a gas mask that made him look like an insect. He bumped into Loretta and giggled and ran away again, arms outstretched as if he were flying.
"The Red Cross donated a big box of gas masks to the bank for the kids to wear during dust storms. My mom is handing them out tonight." "Gas masks," Loretta said, shaking her head. "Jeepers. It's getting worse, my dad says." "We are not talking about gas masks. This is a party, for gosh sakes," Loretta said.
She reached out, took hold of Stella's hands.
"My mom said you can spend the night tonight. I got some magazines from the library. There's a picture of Clark Gable that will make you swoon."
Stella pulled back, looked away.
"What's wrong?" "The bank is closing," Stella said. "Oh, my Uncle Jimmy, the one in Portland, Oregon, he sent my dad a postcard. He reckons the railroad is hiring and there's no dust storms out there."
Loretta took a step back. She didn't want to hear what was coming.
"We're leaving."
9. Loretta leaned out her bedroom window and screamed in frustration. Below her, the chickens squawked in response.
"Fly away, you idiot birds! Can't you tell we're dying here?"
Stella was leaving. Loretta's best and only friend in Lonesome Tree was leaving. The room seemed to close in on her, becoming so small she couldn't breathe. She went downstairs. The house was still. No wind poking at the cracks, no wood settling onto its foundations. She moved easily in the dark. In the past month, they'd turned off the party line phone, no money to pay for it, and now they were really out here all alone. She found the front door and went outside. A bright moon shone out, glazing the barn's roof with silvered light. She smelled the sun-baked dirt and a hint of chicken manure and cigarette smoke? Following the smell of it, she walked around the side of the farmhouse. Beneath the windmill, she saw the red glow of a cigarette tip rise and fall and rise again. Daddy. So he couldn't sleep either. As she approached him, she saw his red eyes and the tear streaks on his cheeks. He'd been out here in the dark, all alone, smoking and crying.
"Daddy?"
"Hey, doll. You caught me."
He tried to sound casual, but the obvious pretense made her feel even worse. If there was one person she trusted to tell her the truth, it was her father. But now it was so bad he was crying.
"You heard the Devereaux's are leaving?"
"I'm sorry, Lolo."
"I'm tired of I'm sorries," Loretta said. "We could leave too, like the Devereaux's and the Mungers and the Moles. Just go."
"They were all talking about leaving at the shindig tonight. Most folks are like your grandparents. They'd rather die here than leave."
"Do they know we might actually die here?"
"Oh, they know, believe me. Tonight your grandfather said, and I quote, 'Bury me here, boys, I ain't leaving.'"
He exhaled smoke.
"They say they're doing it for our future, as if this patch of dirt is all we could ever want.
Maybe we could convince them to leave.
Her father laughed. And maybe Milo will sprout wings and fly away.
Could we leave without them? Lots of folks are leaving. You always say this is America, where anything is possible. We could go to California, or you could get a railroad job in Oregon.
Loretta heard footsteps. Moments later, Mom appeared, dressed in her ratty old robe and work boots, her fine hair all witch away.
Rafe, Mom said, sounding relieved, as if she thought he might have run off.
It was pathetic how close an eye Mom kept on Daddy, on all of them. She was more of a cop than a parent, and she took the fun out of everything.
I missed you when I woke. I thought,
I'm here, he said.
Mom's smile was as thin as everything else about her.
Come inside, both of you. It's late.
Sure, Else,
Daddy said. Loretta hated how beaten her father sounded, how his fire went out around her mother. She sucked the life out of everyone with her sad, long-suffering looks.
This is all your fault.
Mom said,
What am I to blame for now, Loretta? The weather? The depression?
Daddy touched Loretta, shook his head. Don't. Mom waited a moment for Loretta to speak, then turned away and headed for the house. Daddy followed.
We could leave,
Loretta said to her father, who kept walking as if he hadn't heard.
Anything is possible.
The next morning, Elsa woke well before dawn and found Rafe's side of the bed empty. He'd slept in the barn again. Lately, he preferred it to being with her. With a sigh, she got dressed and left her room. In the dark kitchen, Rose stood at the dry sink, her hands deep in water that she'd hauled from the well and poured into the sink. A large cracked mixing bowl lay drying on towels on the counter beside her, towels Elsa had embroidered by hand, at night, by candlelight, in Rafe's favorite colors. She had thought that making a perfect home was the answer to making a marriage happy. Clean sheets scented with lavender, embroidered pillowcases, hand-knit scarves. She'd filled hours with such tasks, poured her heart and soul into them, using thread to say the words she could not utter. A pot of coffee sat on the wood stove, pumping a comforting aroma into the room. A tray of rectangular chickpea panele was on the table, and a tablespoon of olive oil popped in a cast-iron pan on the stove. Beside it, oatmeal bubbled in a pot.
Morning,
Elsa said. She removed a spatula from the drawer and lowered two of the panele into the hot oil. These would be the midday meal, eaten like a sandwich, squeezed with precious drops of preserved lemon.
You look tired,
Rose said, not unkindly.
Rafe isn't sleeping well.
If he'd stopped drinking in the barn at night, it might help.
Elsa poured herself a cup of coffee and leaned against the cabbage rose-papered wall. She noticed the corner of the flooring where the linoleum was coming up. Then she went to turn the panele over, seeing a nice brown crust on them. Rose moved in beside her, took over the cooking. Elsa began to take apart the butter churn. The parts needed to be washed and scalded and put back together in a precise, numbered order, and then stacked for the next use. It was the perfect chore to keep one's mind occupied. A centipede crawled out of its hiding place and plopped onto the counter. Elsa took out a pair of knives and chopped it into pieces. Sharing the house with centipedes and spiders and other insects had become commonplace. Every living thing on the Great Plains sought safety from the dust storms. The two women worked in companionable silence until the sun came up and the children stumbled out of their bedrooms.
I'll feed them, Rose said. Why don't you take Rafe some coffee?
Elsa was grateful for her mother-in-law's insight. Smiling, Elsa said,
Thank you,
poured her husband a cup of coffee, and went outside. The sun was a bright yellow glow in a cloudless cornflower blue sky. Instead of noticing the latest destruction to the land, broken fence posts, damage to the windmill, dirt piles growing in size, she focused instead on the good news.
If she hurried, she would be able to do laundry today, bleach everything into whiteness. There was something about fresh sheets hanging on the line that lifted her spirits. Perhaps it was simply a vision of having accomplished a thing that improved her family's life, even if no one noticed. Tony was up on the windmill, repairing a blade. The bang, bang, bang of his hammer echoed across the endless brown plain. Rafe was in the last place in the world she expected him to be, the family cemetery. A small brown plot of land delineated by a sagging picket fence. Once it had included a beautiful garden with pink morning glories crawling up and over the white picket fence and a carpet of blue-green buffalo grass on the ground. Elsa used to spend an hour here every Sunday, rain, heat, or snow, but she hadn't been out here as often lately. As always, the headstones reminded her of her lost son, of the dreams she'd spun for him while he was in her womb, and the pain that had softened over time, but never gone away. She unclicked the gate, which hung askew on a broken hinge. Dozens of white pickets lay on the ground. Some had broken, others had been yanked out of the ground by the savage wind. Four gray headstones stood from the dirt, three of Rose and Tony's children, all daughters, and Lorenzo. Rafe was kneeling in front of their son's headstone. Lorenzo Walter Martinelli, born 1931, died 1931. Elsa knelt beside him, laid a hand on his shoulder. He turned to her. She had never seen such pain in his eyes, not even when they'd buried their newborn son. Rafe had been only 28 when he'd held his tiny, unbreathing child in his arms and cried for their loss. He had, to the best of her knowledge, never come out here, never knelt at this grave.
"I miss him too,"
Elsa said, stumbling a little over the words.
"Old man Orloff butchered his last steer this week. The poor thing was full of dirt."
"Yes." Elsa frowned at the odd change in topic.
"Aunt asked me why his stomach hurt all the time. How could I tell him that the land is killing him?"
He stood, took her by the hand, and pulled her up to stand with him.
"Let's go."
"Go?"
"West, to California. People are leaving every day. I hear there are railroad jobs to be had, and maybe I'll qualify for that program of FDR's, the Conservation Corps."
"We don't have money for gas."
"We could walk, jump on trains. Folks will give us rides. We will get there. The kids are tough."
"Tough?" She pulled free of his hold, took a step back. "They don't have shoes that fit. We have no money, no food. You've seen the Hooverville photos, what it's like out there. Anthony is 7. How far do you think he can walk? You want him to jump on a moving train?"
"California is different,"
he said stubbornly.
"There are jobs there."
"Your parents won't leave. You know that."
"We could go without them."
He made it a question, not a statement, and she could see how ashamed he was to even ask it.
"Go without them?"
Rafe ran a hand through his hair and looked out over the dead wheat fields and the graves already on this land.
"This damnable wind and drought will kill them. And us. I can't stand it anymore. I can't."
"Rafe, you can't mean this."
This land was his heritage, their future, their children's future. The kids would grow up on this land, always knowing their history, knowing who they were and who they'd come from. They'd learn the pride that came with a good day's work. They would belong somewhere. Rafe didn't know how it felt not to belong, the pain of it, but Elsa did, and she would never inflict that heartache on her children. This was home. He had to know that hard times ended. Land endured, family endured. How could he think they could just leave Tony and Rose here alone? It was unconscionable, unthinkable.
"When it rains..." "Christ, I hate that sentence,"
he said, sounding more bitter than she'd ever heard him. She saw the agony in his eyes, the disappointment, the anger. Elsa wanted to reach out and touch him, but didn't dare. I love you burned in her dry throat.
I just think.
I know what you think.
He walked away and didn't look back. Leave. Just give up on this land and walk away with nothing. Actually walk away. She was still thinking about it hours later, well after night had fallen. She couldn't imagine joining the horde of jobless, homeless hobos and migrants who were headed west. She'd heard it was dangerous to jump onto those trains, that legs and feet could be cut off, bodies severed in half by the giant metal wheels. And there was crime out there. Bad men who'd left their consciences along with their families. Elsa was not a brave woman. Still, she loved her husband. She'd vowed to love, honor, and obey him. Surely, follow him was understood. Should she have told him they'd go to California? At least talked about it? Maybe in the spring, if they'd had rain and a crop, there would be money for gas. And God knew he was unhappy here. So was Loretta. Perhaps they could leave, all of them, and come back when the drought ended. Why not? This land would wait for them. She could at least discuss it with him properly, make him see that she was his wife and they were a team, and if he wanted this enough, she would do it. She would leave this land she had come to love, the only home she'd ever had, for him. She threw a shawl over her worn lawn nightgown, then stepped into the rubber boots by the front door and went outside. Where was he? Out on the windmill, alone, chewing on his disappointment? Or had he hitched up the wagon and gone to the silo so he could sit at the bar and drink whiskey? It was nearly 9 o'clock, and the farm was quiet. The only light on in the house shone in Loretta's upstairs window. Her daughter was in bed reading, just as Elsa had done at her age. She walked out into the yard. The chickens roused themselves lethargically as she passed by and quieted quickly. She heard music coming from her in-law's bedroom. Tony was playing music on his fiddle. Elsa knew that music was how he spoke to Rose in these hard times, how he reminded them of their past and their future, how he said, "I love you." She saw Rafe in the darkness by the corral, an upright slash of black against the black slats of the corral, all of it sheened silver by the light of a waxing moon, the bright orange tip of his cigarette. He heard her footsteps, she could tell. Rafe pulled away from the corral, stubbed out his cigarette, and dropped the unsmoked portion into his shirt pocket. Tony's love song wafted toward them. Elsa stopped in front of Rafe. All it would take was the smallest movement, and she could rest her hand on his shoulder. She knew the faded blue chambray of his work shirt would feel warm after this long, hot day. She'd hemmed and washed and stitched and folded every garment he owned and knew each one by touch. How was it possible that Elsa was close enough to her husband that she could feel the heat coming off him and smell the whiskey and cigarettes on his breath and still feel as if an ocean sloshed between them? He surprised her by taking her hand and pulling her into his arms.
"You remember that first night of ours, out in the truck in front of Stewart's barn?"
Elsa nodded uncertainly. These were things they didn't speak of.
"You said you wanted to be brave. I just wanted to be somewhere else."
Elsa stared up at him, saw his pain, and it hurt her too. "Oh, Rafe." He kissed her on the lips, long and slow and deep, letting his tongue taste hers.
"You were my first kiss,"
he whispered, drawing back just enough to look at her.
"Remember me then."
It was the most romantic thing he'd ever said to her, and it filled her with hope. "Always," she whispered. Tony's music stopped, leaving a heavy silence behind. Insects sang their staccato songs. The geldings moved listlessly in the corral, bumping the fencing with their noses, reminding them that they were hungry. The night around them was black, the huge sky bright with stars. Maybe those were other universes she saw up there. It felt beautiful and romantic, and just now the two of them could be alone on the planet, attended to only by the sounds of the night.
"You're thinking about California,"
she began, trying to find the right words to begin a new conversation.
"Yeah. Aunt walking 1,000 miles on bad shoes, us in a bread line somewhere. You were right. We can't go."
"Maybe in the spring."
Rafe silenced her with a kiss.
"Go to bed,"
he murmured.
"I'll be there soon."
Elsa felt him pulling away, releasing her.
"Rafe, I think we should talk about..."
"Don't fret, Els," he said. "I'll come to bed shortly. We can talk then. I just need to water the animals."
Elsa wanted to stop him and make him listen, but such boldness was beyond her. Deep down, she was always afraid of how flimsy her hold on him was. She couldn't test it. But she would reach for him tonight, touch him with the kind of intimacy she dreamed of. She would overcome whatever was wrong with her and finally please him. She would. And when they were finished making love, she would talk to him about leaving, talk seriously. More important, she would listen. She returned to their room and paced. Finally, she went to the window and peeled away the dirt-crusted rags and newspaper that covered the sill and pane. She could see the windmill, a slash of black lines, a flower, almost, silhouetted against the bejeweled night sky. Rafe was there, leaning against the frame, almost indistinguishable from the windmill. He was smoking. She climbed into bed and pulled the quilt up around her and waited for her husband. The next thing Elsa knew, it was daylight, and she smelled coffee. The rich, bitter aroma drew her out of the comfort of her bed. She finger-combed her hair and slipped into a house dress, trying not to be hurt that Rafe hadn't come to their bed again last night. She rebraided her hair and wrapped it in a coil at the back of her head, pinning it in place and then covering it with a kerchief. She checked on her children, letting them sleep in on this Saturday morning, and headed to the kitchen, where a pot full of last night's potato water had been saved to make bread. All they had for breakfast was wheat cereal, so she got it started. Thank God they had one cow that was still producing milk. Loretta was the first to stumble out of her small second-floor bedroom. Her black bob was a rat's nest of tangles and curls. A sunburn peeled in patches across her cheeks.
"Wheat cereal. Yum," she said, heading to the icebox.
Opening it, she took out the yellow crockery pitcher that held a bit of precious cream and carried it over to the oilcloth-draped table, where the speckled bowls and plates were already in place, upside down to protect from dust. She turned over three bowls. Aunt came out next, climbed up into the chair beside his sister.
"I want pancakes,"
he grumbled.
"I'll put some corn syrup in your cereal," Elsa said.
Elsa served up the cereal, doctored it with cream, and added a little corn syrup to each bowl, and then set down two glasses of cold buttermilk. As the children ate, silently, Elsa headed for the barn. Wind and shifting sand had changed the landscape overnight again, filled in much of the giant crack that had cut through their property. As she passed the hog pen, she saw their only remaining hog kneeling lethargically on the hard-packed earth, and the John Deere one-horse seed drill, unused now, half buried in sand. Beyond that, she saw Rose in the orchard, looking for apples on the cracked ground. In the pen, their two cows stood side by side, heads down, mooing pathetically. Their ribs stood out, their bellies shrunken, their hides blistered with sores. Elsa couldn't help but remember a few years ago, when the younger of the two cows, Bella, had been born. Elsa had fed her by bottle because the cow's mother hadn't survived the birth. Rose had taught Elsa how to make the bottle and get the unsteady calf to take it. Sometimes Bella still followed Elsa around the yard like a pet. "Hey, Bella," Elsa said, stroking the cow's sunken side. Bella looked up, her big brown eyes blinded by dirt, and mooed plaintively.
"I know,"
Elsa said, taking a bucket from the fence post. Elsa led Bella into the relative coolness of the barn, tied her to the center post, and pulled out the milking stool. She couldn't help glancing up into the hayloft, nearly empty now of hay. She was pretty sure Rafe had slept there last night. Again. Elsa had always loved this chore. It had taken her a long time to catch on in the beginning. She had heard 100 tisks from Rose as Elsa tried to master the technique, but master it she had, and now it was one of her favorite chores. She loved being with Bella, loved the sweet smell of fresh milk, the hollow clanking as the first stream hit the metal bucket. She even loved what came next, carrying the bucket of fresh, warm milk to the house, pouring it into the separator, cranking the machine by hand, skimming off the rich yellow cream, saving the whole milk to feed her family, and using skim milk for the animals. Elsa reached out for the cow's barely swollen udder, touched the wind-chapped teats gently. The cow bellowed in pain.
"I'm sorry, Bella,"
Elsa said. She tried again, squeezing as gently as she could, pulling down slowly. A stream of dirt-brown milk squirted out, smelling fecund. Each day, it seemed, milking took longer to reach white, usable milk. The first streams were always dirty like this. Elsa dumped out the brown milk, cleaned the bucket, and tried again. She never gave up, no matter how sad Bella's moans made her or how long it took to get clean milk. When she finished, getting less than they needed, she turned the poor cow out into the paddock. As she passed the horse stalls, Milo and Bruno both snorted heavily and bit at the door, trying to eat the wood. As she locked the barn door behind her, she heard a gunshot. What now? She turned, saw her father-in-law at the hog pen. He lowered his rifle as their last hog staggered sideways and collapsed. Thank God, Elsa murmured to herself. Meat for the children. She waved at him as he hefted the dead hog into a wheelbarrow and headed to the barn to hang it for slaughter. A tumbleweed rolled lazily past her, pushed along by a gentle breeze. Her gaze followed it to the fence line, where the Russian thistles survived against all odds, growing stubbornly even in the drought, against the wind. The cows ate them when there was nothing else. So did the horses. She took the milk into the house and then went outside again, crossing the expanse of dirt that lay between the barn and the fence. The wind plucked at her kerchief as if trying to stop her. The Russian thistles were a tangle of prickles and stems, barely green, wiry, tough, spikes as sharp as pins. She pulled her gloves from her apron pocket and put them on. Making a bowl of her apron, she eased her hand past the sharp, prickly ends and plucked off a green shoot. She tasted it. Not bad. Maybe they could be cooked gently in olive oil, wine, garlic, and herbs. Would they taste like artichokes? Tony loved his artichokes. Or maybe pickling them was the answer. Tomorrow she'd get everyone picking them and find a way to preserve them. At noon, when she'd picked as many as her apron could hold, she went back to the house. Inside, Elsa found the children and Tony already seated at the table for the midday meal.
"I found some grapes,"
Aunt said, bouncing in his seat, beaming at his contribution. Elsa tousled his hair, felt its texture.
"Bath tonight for a little boy I know."
"Do I have to?"
Elsa smiled.
"I can smell you from here."
"Yep." Tony pulled off his hat, revealing a strip of white skin across his brow, and sat down. He downed an entire glass of tea in two gulps, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. Rose came into the kitchen and poured her husband a glass of red wine. Tony dug into his plate of arancini. It was a family favorite, rice balls filled with creamy cheese, swimming in a pancetta and garlic-flavored tomato sauce. Elsa put her pile of thistles into a bowl and set it by the dry sink.
What's that?
Rose asked, wiping her hands on her apron.
Thistles. I think I can figure out a way to make them palatable. They almost taste like artichokes.
Rose sighed.
It's come to that. Italians eating horse food. Madonna mia.
Where's Rafe?
Elsa asked, looking around. I need to talk to him.
Ain't seen him all day,
Aunt said.
I look, too.
Elsa walked out to the porch, rang the bell for the midday meal, and waited, looking out over the farm. The horses and wagon were here, so he hadn't gone to town. Maybe he was in their room. She headed back into the house and went into their bedroom. Sunlight made the pale white walls look golden. A large framed portrait of Jesus stared at her. The room was empty, just the bed and the chest of drawers she shared with her husband and the washstand with its oval mirror that captured her image. Everything was as it should be, except there were marks on the floor, coming out from beneath her bed, as if something had been put under the bed or taken out from underneath it. She lifted the quilt and looked underneath the bed. She saw her suitcase, the one she'd brought into her marriage, and the box of baby clothes she'd saved just in case. Something was missing. What? She dropped to her knees for a better look. What was missing? Rafe's suitcase. The one he'd packed all those years ago to go off to college. The one he'd unpacked when her father left Elsa here. She glanced sideways. His clothes were gone from the hooks by the door, as was his hat. She got up slowly and went to the dresser, opened the top drawer, his drawer. One blue chambray shirt was all that was left. 10. She couldn't believe he'd left in the middle of the night without a word. She'd spent 13 years living with him, sharing his bed at night, bearing his children. She'd known he'd never been in love with her, but this? She walked out of her room, saw the family, her family, their family, seated at the table, talking. Aunt was retelling his grape-finding story. Rose looked up, saw Elsa, and frowned.
Elsa?
Elsa wanted to tell Rose this terrible thing and be held, but she couldn't say anything until she was sure. Maybe he had walked to town for something, with all of his belongings.
I have errands, Elsa said, seeing Rose's disbelief.
Elsa hurried out of the house and grabbed Loretta's bicycle. Climbing aboard, she pedaled through the thick dirt that layered the driveway, her legs working hard. More than once, she had to zigzag around the dead branches of the fallen trees, which had been exposed in the last dust storm. She stopped at the mailbox, looked in. Nothing. On the way to town, she didn't see a single automobile or wagon out on the road in this heat. Birds congregated on the telephone wires overhead, chattered down at her. Several cows and horses roamed free, plaintively moaning for food and water. Unable to butcher or care for their animals, farmers had let them go to fend for themselves. By the time she reached Lonesome Tree, her hair had worked itself free from the pins she'd used to hold it back from her face, and her kerchief was damp. On Main Street, she stopped. A tumbleweed rolled past her, scraped her bare calf. Lonesome Tree lay anesthetized before her, shops boarded up, nothing green, the town's namesake cottonwood half dead. Up and down the street, boards had been ripped away by the wind. She pedaled toward the train depot and got off the bike. Maybe he was still here. Inside was a room full of empty benches, a dirty floor, a whites-only water fountain. She walked to the ticket window. Behind a small arched opening sat a man in a dusty white shirt with black elbow guards.
Hello, Mr. McIlvaine.
Hey, Ms. Martinelli,
the man said.
Was my husband here recently? Did he buy a ticket?
He looked down at the papers on his desk.
Please, sir, do not make me interrogate you.
This is humiliating enough for me, wouldn't you agree?
He didn't have any money.
Did he say where he wanted to go?
You don't want me to say.
I do.
He sighed and looked up at her.
He said anywhere but here.
He said that?
If it helps, he pretty near looked ready to cry.
The man pulled out a crumpled, stained envelope and pushed it through the iron bars of the ticket window.
He said to give you this.
He knew I'd come?
Wives always do.
She drew in a steadying breath.
So, if he had no money, maybe...